Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, June 13, 2025, and our friend Dmitry Orlov is back with us. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Good to be with you.
Dmitry, let us know how we can support your work. Tell us about your web blog. Yeah. Go ahead.
Go to boosty.to, boosty.to / club Orlov, clubOrlov. And as events unfold, I'll be blogging there. I have some articles there, fresh articles in both English and French. French comes out about a week later. And so please go there and read up on everything that I've been doing.
Yeah. We were going to talk about Ukraine, but we're going to start with something that has happened in the Middle East, the Israeli attack on Iran, Dmitry. Yesterday, Donald Trump tweeted that he wants a deal with Iran. All his government are doing everything to make a deal with Iran. They're just focused on that. And at the night, the Israelis attacked Iran. Your take on what's going on with, while the United States is negotiating with Iran, Israel attacks Iran. What does that mean?
It means that the United States isn't negotiating with Iran. The United States isn't negotiating with anyone. I think the right approach to Trump is Kim Jong-un's approach, who returns letters from Trump unopened. There is nothing to discuss with Trump. He's a blithering idiot. He said 15 different things in as many days about the Iran deal. Nobody makes deals that way. The only person in the world who thinks that Trump is capable of making deals is Trump. Everybody else has written him off. So there's nothing to be said about that at all. That's just Trump doing the usual Trump thing, which is bloviating, spouting nonsense, posting on social media, as if that matters to serious people anywhere in the world. And it's just nonsense for us to distract ourselves from more serious things. Now, in terms of what this war was, okay, well, it was political assassination on the part of the Israelis. They're good at political assassination. So they're at it again. They also seem to have blown up some things in Iran. But we don't know yet, but it doesn't seem like they hit anything nuclear, because it's deep underground, and the Israelis probably don't know what it is. So the stated object of this attack, to neutralize the Iranian nuclear program, or the Iranian uranium enrichment program, which is a very nice program, by the way. I don't think it's done anything. Well, they killed a few specialists in the nuclear field, but Iran has plenty of those. So I don't think that's going to stop it. They also killed some high-placed Iranian officials who responded to this dire threat from Israel by sleeping in their beds so that they would be easy for Israel to kill, or by staying in their undefended offices, in the case of the guards of the Iranian Revolution, of the Islamic Revolution. So that tells you that the Iranians are not really up to snuff either. So it's the lame attacking the lame, I would say. It's a nothing war. Nothing has been achieved. Nothing will be achieved. Israel is in a very bad state politically. It's been fighting Hamas in Gaza for 3 years running now, losing lots of tanks, lots of men, and a few women, achieving nothing except a lot of destruction and genocide. So it needs a little victorious war, or a war that at least it can represent as being victorious somehow. Whether it actually achieves anything or not is ridiculous. So rounding back up to Trump, there was a very nice deal negotiated over many years with Iran. the agreement. Everybody signed on to it, and then Trump rolls into office and cancels it. That's it for Trump. He doesn't get to make any more deals with Iran. He should go and play golf. And so that's where it stands. Silly little nothing war. We don't know the details except a bunch of people got killed.
Dmitry, when it comes to the way that Israel is behaving in the Middle East, don't you think that with the escalations, we know that at least in the last 24 hours, they were attacking Gaza. They started attacking Iran as well. But what is the game for the United States in the Middle East? I don't see, because decapitation for a country with 90 million people, how you can believe that by killing 5-10 people at the top, you can change anything in Iran? Because when there are people out there arguing that this is the regime change operation, they're going to change the regime by this operation. How is, in my opinion, is so much ridiculous you'd feel that by killing some people in Iran, you can change the government, you can change the country. Even Netanyahu comes out, says that we're going to save you, Iranian people. We are two old nations. We're going to... It's unbelievable, the level of ignorance.
Well, I think that there was something going on in Iran that nobody talks about, which is incredible level of incompetence. Why were these people sleeping in their beds when an attack was underway and obviously they were the targets? Why is that? Why was there no air defense system? You know, Iran has some. Why did they just submit? Why didn't they shoot anything down at all? Why did they just lay down and roll over? You know, is there a donkey laden with shekels that walked to Tehran to bribe everyone there? You know, that would be a very Eastern thing to do. Why is Iran suddenly so incompetent? That's a big question in my mind. As far as what Netanyahu is doing, he's just being Netanyahu. He's got a little bit of time to do something spectacular before the rest of his political ammunition in Israel fades away or is wasted. And so he's doing his best. He wants a little victorious war, or at least something, you know. Obviously, he hasn't achieved anything in Lebanon. He hasn't achieved much of anything in Syria. And he certainly hasn't achieved anything in Gaza except genocide. That doesn't make him a successful person. He needs to paint some kind of a picture of success. And look, we killed a bunch of people in Iran. It's about the best he can do.
How do you feel the way that Russia perceives what's going on in the Middle East?
Indifferently. Russia is concerned about Israel giving Patriot batteries to the Ukrainians. That is not a very popular thing with the Russians for the Israelis to have done. Russia doesn't like the fact that there's an Israeli ambassador in the Ukraine who is crazy. Is insane and spouts anti-Russian nonsense. The Russians don't like that either. As far as you know, what's happening in Iran, well, you know, Syria was a friend of Russia too, and Putin said, we can't be more Syrian than the Syrians. So when the Syrians failed to reform their system so that it could be survivable and brought the situation to a point where their president escaped to Moscow, what did the Russians do? Nothing. It's not their problem. Iran is also not Russia's problem. Russia would like Iran to be rich, prosperous, and happy, but it's not going to volunteer to fight Iran's fight if Iran refuses to defend itself, which it could very well do, but isn't doing. Now, why is that?
Yeah, it seems that these air defense systems were sabotaged somehow. I don't know what has happened in Iran, but they are talking about the sabotage in the air defense systems in critical points of Iran. And we expect that Iran would attack Israel. I would assume that these Arab states would help Israel as they did before. And the United States, Donald Trump said that they're going to defend Israel. It doesn't matter who's attacking Israel. Do you feel that the Middle East is on somehow, the Iran would attack the American bases in the Arab states, or maybe going beyond that?
Well, I think that they're going to bounce some rocks in Israel, maybe destroy Dimona. Or try to, again, you know, cause some death and destruction and leave that at that. I don't think we need to make things more complicated than they need to be. Accidents could happen, but Iran, it would be the paragon of stupidity for Iran to respond to Israeli attacks by attacking American military bases. It would just be unfathomably stupid. It would also be rather strange for Arab countries to interfere in what is essentially a Jewish-Persian fight. Why would they do that? It's not their fight. Given that some of these Arab countries have a lot of American hostages on their territory, also known as soldiers, I don't think that the Arabs really want any sort of an escalation at all. There's, you know, it's a feeble attempt at a war, very feeble, and both sides are rather bad at it. The idea that the Israelis could neutralize Iran's nuclear capabilities is bizarre, strange. Can't they figure out that the stuff is deep underground and they don't even know where it is? As far as political assassination, well, you know, the Jews do that all the time. And so that's nothing new.
Is that going to change Iran's policy toward nuclear bombs? They said that if they're attacked by the United States before, the official, top officials in Iran said that they're going to make nuclear bombs. And we know that the United States together, they tried with Yemen. In Yemen, they tried to do everything in Yemen. They couldn't reach the ammunition of Yemenis in Yemen. So far, they couldn't achieve anything in terms of the nuclear facilities of Iran. And they hit some targets on the surface, but they couldn't reach anything under the ground. And how is that going to change the Iran's strategy, the Iran's policy vis-a-vis nuclear weapons?
Well, the closest ally that Iran has right now is Russia. And Russia is on record saying it doesn't want a nuclear-armed Iran. So does it want to waste its relationship with Russia for the sake of some very unnecessary posturing? I don't know. Again, you know, the question is about incompetence and stupidity, not about strategy. And there's no accounting for incompetence and stupidity.
Yeah. What are the implications of what's going on in the Middle East for the conflict in Ukraine? We know that there is the Russians and Ukrainians are talking directly to each other, but at least the main factor of these sort of talks is the United States. Is the United States capable of negotiating? Is the United States capable of making a deal? Looking at 2015 and those agreements, Minsk 1 and Minsk 2, 2014 and 2015, and two guarantors, Germany and France, they did the same. Right now, today when I read that the French government, it says that Israel has the right to defend itself. It was a preemptive attack. I don't know Iran, if Iran wanted to attack Israel. Nothing. They said that they're going to attack if they're attacked by Israel or the United States. And how the behavior is the same. Look at Europeans, look at the United States. What are the implications for Russia and ongoing negotiations?
There are no ongoing negotiations. They're technical discussions. There are two teams. They got together in Istanbul twice. They had some technical discussions. They exchanged some documents, which they did not discuss. There was no official discussion of these documents between the two parties. There are no peace negotiations with the Americans either. And all that happened is exchange of prisoners and exchange of bodies. 45 Ukrainian bodies to one Russian body. That represents the actual ratio of casualties in this war. The Ukrainians are basically being slaughtered. Unfortunately, there's this Ukrainian government that realizes that if the slaughter stops, they're out of power. And they don't want that. So they need to keep that war going. Now, the Russians are doing fairly reasonable things to make the whatever remaining population there is in the Ukraine to come to the realization of who their real enemies are. Their real enemies are the United States, Europe, and their own government. They have to rise up against it. The Russians can't do that for them. The Ukrainians have to fight their own civil war. And the fact, the optics of returning these bodies so that they can be given decent Christian burial by their families, and the way the Ukrainian government first refused to accept these bodies and then passed a bill saying the reparations to the families for their fallen will be paid out 2 years after the war is over, which is ridiculous. Basically, it's an admission that they don't have the money, that they're breaking their promises, and that's on top of them going bankrupt internationally. That all shows you that this government is basically the enemy of its people. That is being very forcefully demonstrated through this process of technical meetings, technical discussions. The only reason Russia participates, well, there are two reasons. One is to advance the cause of Russian victory in the Ukraine. The second is to convince the Russian population that they will not compromise with the Americans or with the Ukrainians or whoever else. That is all really that's going on. There is nothing else that's really affecting it. The Russian steamroller is continuing to roll and picking up speed.
Yeah. What strategic impact will Ukraine's operation Spiderweb, as they call it, on June 1st drone strike on 5 Russian air bases? And Putin said that Russia is expanding air defense drone forces and AI integrated in military. And how the concept of Russia toward the conflict in Ukraine is changing vis-a-vis the latest attack, because Financial Times reported that they used AI. That could be some sort of propaganda. But when it comes to the way that Putin is responding to the attack, what are the main points that you can mention?
Well, the attack on the planes is sort of not interesting. Let me put it that way. They weren't strategic planes. They weren't part of the strategic triad. These are 40-year-old airframes that are in rotation doing tactical things, not strategic things, launching rockets towards the Ukraine, perhaps. Perhaps just doing exercises. But the nuclear triad of Russia was unaffected by these attacks. That is very important to keep in mind. And it's sort of a legitimate target. The Ukrainians managed to hit some Russian bombers. Well, you know, somebody deserves a medal for that. But the much more important is the fact that there were also concurrently with that terrorist attacks on a passenger train, where lots of people got hurt and quite a few people died. That was specifically an attack targeting civilians, including women and children. And the Kiev regime took responsibility for it, which means that it's a terrorist regime and needs to be dealt with as terrorist regimes are dealt with by Russia, which is it needs to be destroyed. There will be no further negotiation with it because these are terrorists. Now, some people say that, you know, there was a Crocus City incident a little while ago, and Putin said somewhat similar things. But that was not really a technical attack engineered, carefully engineered from Kiev. It was just a bunch of people with Kalashnikovs running around and setting things on fire, you know, cans of gasoline and relatively worn out machine guns. So that didn't rise to the level of state terrorism. It was state-sponsored terrorism. There's a lot of that sort of thing going around. But this attack on the train was state terrorism. There was a plastic explosive and remote detonators and all of the stuff that the Ukrainians engineered. So that is unforgivable. And that is far more important than this attack on a few elderly bombers that took place.
Financial Times, as I mentioned, reported that Ukrainians use AI to the capability that they gained from AI to attack Russia was huge, and they can a game changers, all of that. And somehow it seems that they're preparing the United States to, they're trying to convince the United States that Ukraine is capable of continuing the conflict with Russia. They can attack Russia. They're capable of doing that, even with the use of AI, if they don't have the manpower. We know that in Ukraine, the main problem is manpower. And those people who were recruited by the army, they're not trained, they don't know how to fight, all of these problems in Ukraine. And with the case of morale is somehow the biggest problem with Ukraine. Your take on the way that Europeans are somehow, in my opinion, trying to convince, as Netanyahu did with Donald Trump, trying to convince Donald Trump that Ukraine is capable of doing this if we go on and on with the conflict in Ukraine?
I really don't know what that has to do with. Financial Times should stick to finances. What does it know about, you know, military issues having to do with artificial intelligence? What I've heard is that these were just regular off-the-shelf drones with some explosive charges duct taped to them that had SIM cards, local SIM cards, installed in them and used wireless internet, 4G LTE or something like that, and were steered by operators somewhere, probably in the Ukraine, most likely, that were launched from containers that were sitting on trucks. Where's artificial intelligence in that? I think somebody may have just made that up, you know, it's artificial intelligence. Let's start repeating it ad nauseum. But is there any reality behind it? I have no idea. What's far more interesting is that yesterday this test took place where Russian officials were present and where they flew a wide variety of drones and knocked them out of the sky using lasers. And they tested a whole bunch, not just one or two, but a whole bunch of different laser technologies for knocking drones out of the sky. They even simulated different climatic conditions, rain, etc., fog, to see whether they would still work. They picked some winners, and those winners are going to go into production. So pretty soon, Russian army trucks will come with lasers that will shoot down drones, and which is, you know, a fun piece of technology as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, forget artificial intelligence. This is lasers. Why don't we talk about that instead?
Dmitry, the conflict in Ukraine and the way that the West sees the conflict, it seems that Russia, as time goes by, is deciding to get everything done on the battlefield. Look at the Sumy region, what's going on in Sumy region. Look at the front line and the way that Russia is trying to expand the buffer zone. What's the strategy on that Russia is pursuing right now?
The strategy is to see where Russian territory is being hit from. And Russian territory now includes former Ukrainian territory that has voted to join Russia. So that's Crimea, Lugansk, Donetsk, Kherson, Zaporozhye. And so the problem is solved by creating a buffer zone, moving Ukrainian troops so far away that they can't use artillery or they can't use their relatively short-range rocketry to hit Russian territory. If they get more advanced rockets, then that buffer zone will need to be improved. If attacks come from, say, NATO territory, then the buffer zone will have to include some NATO countries, I suppose. And so on until people get the clue that maybe it's a bad idea to keep hitting Russian territory. Some people are very hard to convince. Mostly these are Ukrainians, though. I don't think anybody else is that interested. Maybe the Germans. The Germans seem to have gone completely insane. But mostly it's the people in the Kiev regime who think that hitting Russia is somehow going to please their masters in Washington. I don't think that even works anymore. But that's what that's all about. You know, the buffer zone will probably be somewhere around 100 kilometers, something like that. That's what they're creating in the Sumy region right now. That's what they'll create in Dnipropetrovsk region also, which they're rolling into. And the nice thing about those regions is that they're relatively defenseless. The Ukrainians are not dug in those regions. So they basically just retreat, and the Russians take over large chunks of territory. They're advancing faster than ever before.
And do you feel that the Ukrainian negotiators or the team on the part of the Ukrainian government are capable of achieving anything with Russia beyond the exchange of prisoners, the soldiers that on both sides that are trying to do that? But beyond that, is that because in the memorandum that Russia proposed, there are 33 points mentioned in that memorandum. How many of these points are related to Ukraine, and how much Ukraine can move toward what Russia is asking for?
I don't think that those are the right people to talk to. As I said, Ukraine has to go through a cycle of civil war, and the people who are currently in government have to be hung on lampposts or whatever as criminals, or shot or whatever, or run away. And then something might happen. The memorandum is there for the purposes of establishing what Russia would agree with right now, because the next memorandum will be a lot harsher. It'll probably include a few more former Ukrainian regions that become Russian. Nikolaev and Odessa come to mind. And Sumy, of course. These are Russian-speaking regions. It's Russia's approach to placate their domestic audience, to tell their domestic audience that no, they will not compromise, they will achieve victory. But as far as negotiating with these people that Kiev sends, I don't think that that's even being considered. These are technical discussions. And the purpose of those technical discussions is to further the cause of Russian victory over the Ukraine and unconditional capitulation by the Ukrainian regime, and a stand down by NATO, because once NATO concedes that the Ukraine has lost, NATO might as well disband, which is, you could say, a stretch goal for Russia.
As you've mentioned, we've learned that Israel is sending Patriot system to Ukraine. The government denied it, and then the Israeli ambassador said that, I don't know who to believe, but it seems that they sent the Patriot system. This is not the first time doing this. But when it comes to the air defense system of the United States and the West in Ukraine, do you think they have achieved anything in Ukraine? They can counter what Russia has to attack Ukraine?
No. The Ukrainian, the Kyiv regime keeps spouting absolute preposterous lies about the number of drones and rockets, Russian drones and rockets that they shoot down. But evidence shows that they can't shoot down much of it at all. If they do shoot something down, then that's a happy accident for them. On the other hand, just about everything that they can throw at Russia, with a few exceptions, some apartment buildings and churches got hit here and there. Most of that stuff gets shot down. So Russia is really far beyond anything that NATO can provide in terms of air defense systems. And now Russia is advancing into anti-drone systems, taking that threat really seriously. So the Ukrainians really, just take it. They sit there and take it. And I recently saw some really remarkable footage of Ukrainian air defense rockets flying up into the sky and going pop, because they self-destruct when they can't find a target. So a bunch of Russian missiles race through the sky, then some air defense rockets take off and can't find their targets and go pop. And that's something like $1 million a pop. So that's beautiful. You know, what better way to bankrupt NATO than that?
Germany has decided to send long-range weapons and increasing military aid. And Europe is moving toward that direction. And I would wonder how much more Europe is capable of escalating the conflict in Ukraine, considering the capabilities of Ukrainians. I don't know if they're trying to send more mercenaries to Ukraine, because they know the situation is not that good for Ukrainians, for the Ukrainian army to continue with the conflict. And how your take on the way that Europe may participate in some sort of operation against Russia?
Well, Mertz keeps talking out both sides of his mouth about sending some Taurus missiles, cruise missiles, to the Ukraine. Those have to be accompanied by lots of German technicians. Also, those have to come with some NATO jets, because those are air-to-ground missiles. And the air component is not something that the Ukrainians can supply. They don't have any planes that can launch those missiles, okay? That's the basic point. Germans, maybe Swedes do. So Mertz, he's kind of like, he's a lightweight, he's a kind of a finance guy. He had a job for BlackRock. Why the hell he is now Bundeskanzler, nobody can tell. He barely got that job. And he likes to snort the white powder, as we found out recently. So we don't know whether he has a functioning brain or not. Some people in Germany are absolutely appalled at how disorganized his thinking is. So he said something about sending those missiles to the Ukraine, but then maybe not. Boris Pistorius is somewhat more serious as a person. He has an evil temper, but at least he has a functional brain. And he said that there won't be any Taurus missiles for the Ukrainians. He said that recently. And so this is an endless talking point. Yes, we will send them. No, we won't send them. Yes, we will send them. No, we won't send them. Ad nauseum for us to talk about. And I'm really tired of talking about it because there's nothing to be achieved. Yes, these missiles are long range, and they have the ability to hug the terrain if properly programmed, but they won't change a thing. In terms of the overall project that Russia is pursuing, the project of total victory over the Ukraine, it will not change it at all. And there's nothing that NATO can do to change the outcome at this point, which is why they're freaking out.
And that increases the threat of having terrorist attacks on Russian soil. And we know that the Russian general, he came out of his house and they killed him. And they do these things. They have this sort of mindset. I don't know where does it come from, but they feel that if they can, some people in the country, they can destroy the government, the willing on the part of government to fight back. But they feel this way. What is the long-term strategy on the part of Russia with these sort of terrorist attacks?
Uncover them before they take place. And they do pretty well with that. In the West, you only hear about the attacks that are successful. You do not hear about the dozens of attacks that the Russians managed to stop or thwart. And that is a constant stream of them in Russia. So most of these terrorist attacks are not successful. And what the Russian goal is to make very few of them successful, as few as possible. There will always be a mess up, an accident, or an unlucky accident. What the Russians are trying to do is prevent them. Anti-terrorist attacks, surveillance and arrests and all kinds of other methods being used to make sure that as few terrorist attacks actually succeed as possible.
Do you feel that Europeans would encourage, would somehow help Ukrainians in their terrorist attack if they decide to go with that plan? Or they're going to put an end, if Ukraine is not any more capable of fighting, they're going to say, so let's find something else. Let's find another solution for the case of Ukraine. Because if something goes on and on in Ukraine with these terrorist attacks, they can backfire on us. Is that important for their security, for the mindset of the security of Europe?
Well, I think that these terrorist attacks are a way for the Ukrainians to feel like they still have some sort of a game going on. If the Ukrainians give up, I don't think the European states, that NATO will transform itself into a terrorist organization. I think that is beyond what NATO members will tolerate. I think that it's a little bit too dangerous for, say, Great Britain to directly stage terrorist attacks against Russia. I could be wrong. Maybe they've lost their minds and would try something like that. But I doubt that would really be the direction they would head.
Dmitry, when at this stage of the conflict like in Ukraine, when you look at the scene, when you look at the way that Russia is trying to, with the memorandum, the way that they're trying to somehow putting out, the way that they see a solution for a Ukrainian settlement, do you feel that the main issue remains to be NATO expansion, or the very important issue for Russia is Ukraine and the future of the western part of Ukraine?
Well, NATO hasn't been expanding lately, if you notice. if NATO, if the war, or once the war in the Ukraine is lost by the West, NATO no longer serves any useful function and might as well disband. Also, it is quite clear that the United States wants out of NATO, and all it wants out of the Europeans is money. 5% of GDP towards defense, and the way the entire defense establishment is structured throughout NATO, is that money has to be given to the Americans. So basically, this is an effort by the Americans to extort as much money out of the Europeans as possible while giving them nothing of value, because we know that all of this gear that has been fed into Europe is now rusting on the sides of the road there, and in bits of woods here and there, because it's all half of it got destroyed, and the rest wasn't very useful. So what would they achieve by giving 5% of their GDP to the Americans for weapons that don't work against Russia? At that point, then NATO might as well just disband. And the good question is, what will the Europeans do next? Because traditionally, they fight wars with each other. Russia is kind of like too dangerous for them to pick a fight with, but you know, they have a lot of issues between, say, Poland and Germany. They're Poles living on German land. There are a lot of issues in the Balkans. You know, Balkans could explode at any moment. There are lots of little unsolved territorial disputes throughout Europe. So maybe the Europeans should just have lots of little wars with each other, like they used to in the bad old days.
Yeah. When it comes to China, and when they look at the situation in Ukraine and right now in the Middle East, the situation between Israel and Iran, do they need to do anything or just sit back, see how the United States is just getting more involved, more and more involved? They're not going to pivot to China. They're not going to pivot to the Pacific. How is that the way that they're feeling right now?
Well, there was some negotiation going on between the United States and China, and the result is that for 6 months, I think, the United States, certain United States companies, got temporary licenses to import rare earths, so they don't have to stop their production lines. They can continue making planes and cars, etc. Which is a very good thing for them. What did the United States concede in exchange? Nobody really talks about it, but I heard some people who ventured an educated guess that what they conceded is Taiwan. So China is going to continue providing rare earth metals to the United States, meaning that the United States industry is not going to instantly collapse. And in exchange, the United States is going to go back to treating Taiwan as Chinese, which is traditionally what it's always done. But this kind of like talking out both sides of its mouth for some kind of like a phantom strategic advantage didn't work out so well. So maybe they'll stop, and the world will be more peaceful.
Dmitry, when it comes to the Middle East, one of the main concerns on the part of Russia and Iran, both countries, even China, is the situation, what has happened in Syria, how these people gathered a coalition. All of the government in Syria is the outcome, or is the sum of all the vectors that are against Iran, Russia, and China, all gathered in Syria. Don't you think that it seems that after all, Russia, China, and Iran can come together, and they have to decide about how do they want Middle East to be in the future? Because with the rise of the government in with Daesh, with Al-Qaeda, whatever they call them, in Syria, it seems that they're supporting they're doing a lot of help to the government in Syria, is Al-Jolani and his gang. Is that gonna change the strategy of these three countries in a long run? When I talk with Paul Carrick Roberts, he always pointed out he doesn't understand why these three countries don't come together and make a treaty, make some sort of agreement among them to go strategically, to fight strategically with the United States, with the presence of the United States in the Middle East or beyond Middle East. We know that the case of Russia, with the case of China, it's not just a small region being influenced by that. It's the whole region influenced by what's going on in the Middle East.
Well, Paul Craig Robert is a strange character. He likes genocide. I realized that he is a bit of a weirdo when he started saying that Putin should kill a lot more Ukrainians to impress the Americans. He actually wrote that. And that was the point at which I said goodbye, genocidal maniac. Now, he seems to be dwelling in the past where countries came together and decided the affairs of other countries. So what to do with this territory that somebody came up with called Syria? It's not a real country. It never was. It was part of the Ottoman Empire for a while, that territory, the Levant. It's sort of a mystical designation. Why should the Russians or the Chinese or anyone else decide something about territory that isn't theirs? The new way of the world is take care of your own. And if Syria, for instance, was a major threat to Russia or to China, they would do something to neutralize that threat. But right now, Syria is only a threat maybe to Turkey and through Turkey to the European Union, because what's going on there will result in even more waves of refugees, and Turkey is already full up with Syrians. So I think what will happen is that Syria will be forgotten. It will disintegrate. It's already disintegrated to a large extent. And so there will be a northern chunk that will somehow be influenced by Turkey, and a southern chunk that will somehow be influenced by Israel. And maybe the Americans will have something to do with it, maybe not. But the Americans seem to be pulling out of there as quickly as they can. And so I don't think that Syria will be much of a topic of discussion moving forward.
Yeah, the topic really is beyond Syria, beyond the radicalism in the region. It's not just about Syria and what's going on in Syria. We know Uyghurs are in Syria. We know where did they come from. We have people from Central Asia coming to Syria. These are main concerns on the part of both Russia, Iran, and together with China. And I would, how do you see that? Because it's not just Syria, is about the way that the West is capable of manipulating the region. We know that Russia, when it comes to Dagestan, to Chechnya, these are long-term problems. They can cause long-term problems for these countries. We have the situation in Iran as well is the same. We have China with the case of Uyghurs. Is that going to be considered by these three countries, Iran, Russia, and China?
I don't know. I can speak about Russia. You know, China has the Uyghurs pretty well under control. You know, some have escaped and joined some paramilitary groups. Russia is very keen at this point in administrating its 25% Muslim population in a way that creates moderate Islam, not non-politicized. It blocks political Islam, and there are it's there are Muslim people in Russia whose job is to block political Islam. And so that works within Russia. It works to some extent in the Central Asian republics, although I would say it works even better in Central Asian republics than in Russia. So Russia has something to learn from them. Political Islam doesn't really go very far in Central Asian republics anymore. Now, what will happen if political Islam rears its ugly head in Syria again? Well, maybe when Russia is done with the Ukraine, it can go back to bombing Daesh or whatever you want to call it, Al-Qaeda, in Syria and kill a bunch more of them like it did the last time. They seem to have that pattern pretty well established. But from Russia's point of view, I don't think the situation is that dire at this point. I think Russia has other priorities.
I don't know if we can call what's going on in Syria political Islam because they're not. We can be honest about that. They're not political Islam. They're not anything to do with. If they were, why Al-Qaeda, Daesh, ISIS? Why they didn't attack anything? You look at the way that they attack Russia and Iran in recent years. Why they didn't attack Israel? Why did they not attack Israel, in your opinion? They made these people. They're not, they pretend to be Muslim, but I don't see that.
Well, their foot soldiers are brainwashed using very rudimentary bits of something that superficially looks like Islam. In that sense, they're Islam. But why don't they attack Israel, or why don't they attack the United States? Or, you know, if you kind of like eliminate 9/11 from the discussion, because that was organized in a very interesting way. Well, they don't bite the hand that feeds them. That it's as simple as that. You know, this Islamic radicalism is very much an American creation, engineered initially in Afghanistan in order to fight the Russians in Afghanistan, and the Russians were there trying to defend socialism. So it was socialism against Islamic radicalism, Al-Qaeda, whatever you want to call it. It's an American creation, and if you look at all of the if you look at the brand of ISIS, Daesh, the flag, the uniforms, how they're filmed, etc. It's Hollywood. Yeah, it's clearly just American producers and brand and advertising agencies being paid to make that entire organization pop on camera.
Dmitry, before wrapping up, how we can support you?
Once again, go to https://.
Right below your picture is written. Go ahead.
Yes. Boosty.to. To stands for the island of Tonga, where the website is registered. It's actually a Dutch company, so don't think that, you know, people will come and shoot your dog because you're giving money to the Russians or whatever. It's all very above board. And beyond that, it's Club Orlov, C-L-U-B-O-R-L-O-V. I'm glad to see that quite a few people are signing up. I publish one or two articles every week, in which I go into much more detail than I can possibly squeeze into 1 hour a week with Nima. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dmitry. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.